are re-recording this part of our tape due to an error we had, and I'm speaking to cover up the bad introduction we had, okay?
1993, and we're at the home of our respondent who's going to introduce himself. And the two interviewers are Harold Kimball and Howard Braun for the National Council of Jewish Women. Now, Mr. D. Roy, would you please give us your name, address, and age, and we will continue.
All right, my name is Mayer, middle name Arthur, and last name D. Roy. I'm 62 years of age. I've been a resident of Pittsburgh all my life. And you can continue, and I guess the time right now is approximately
3:10. Mr. DeRoy, let's start at the beginning. Your parentage, your brother, sister, schooling, at the beginning.
All right. I was born on February 24th, 1931, 2:18 a.m. in the morning. It was a Tuesday at Elizabeth Steele McGee Hospital. My mother was Irene DeRoy, my father was Dr. Mayer DeRoy.
He was?
Okay, he was an orthopedic surgeon, and he served at many hospitals in Pittsburgh for many years. As a matter of fact, he had a career lasting over 50 years, and he was one of the finest orthopedic surgeons.
Mother?
My mother came from Carrick. Her maiden name was Irene Jagman. My mother and dad married in 1929, right after the stock market crash. And a short time thereafter, my father's father, who owned the S.H. DeRoy jewelry stores, passed away. And of course, fortunately, through all the depression, S.H. DeRoy jewelry stores, being one of the finest jewelry stores chains in this general area, did survive. It was difficult, but they managed to survive. At that time, S.H. DeRoy was taken over by, after my grandfather died, by Samuel DeRoy. He did a fine job.
Who was your uncle?
So, well, that's my great uncle, actually. Yeah. It was my father's father's brother. And in 1973, the S.H. DeRoy stores were sold to...
You worked in your uncle's jewelry store?
From time to time, I worked in my uncle's jewelry store. It was not of great interest to me. And as I said, in 1973, S.H. DeRoy was sold to the K Company of Cleveland. Mm-hmm. K Jewelers is now owns the S.H. DeRoy jewelry chain, and of course they're very successful. I was born and raised in Squirrel Hill, originally on Beechwood Boulevard, then later on we moved to 1321 Malvern, and I attended Whiteman School on Solway Street. After I graduated Whiteman School, I then attended Taylor Alderdice High School. I again graduated. And I spent several years at the University of Pittsburgh.
Before we get that far, you have a sister.
And then I was not drafted, but I did enlist in the Korean conflict in 1952. I also had a sister, Marilyn DeRoy. She had no middle name. And she was born in 1935. She went to, I'll get to school shortly, but anyhow, she also went to college. She went to Miami University. Her school was Mount Mercy. Mm-hmm. And her dad was on the staff of Mount Mercy. He assisted the people there. And of course, her schooling was very good. She went then, as I said before, to Miami University, where she met her husband, Byron Chudum, or her future husband at that time. After several years, He graduated as an attorney. He graduated, took the bar exam immediately thereafter, and became an attorney in Florida as well as in Indiana. He came from Gary, Indiana. So naturally, my sister and he moved to Gary, Indiana. After his schooling, when he became a very successful lawyer, he worked with his father, Morris Chudum, who was also an attorney. Unfortunately, he was a great father. I have a niece and nephew. He died in 86, of brain cancer.
And she now lives?
And she now lives in Chicago, and she's remarried, and she lives with Meyer Garfin. And so in other words, she is married to Meyer Garfin. She's Mrs. Meyer Garfin.
Can I ask you a little bit about your early family life? Your schooling, your home practices, and your early religious
I see what you're getting at. All right. Now, number one, I wrote a Scholem. That I graduated Taylor Aldridge in 1949. 2 years prior to that, in 47. I was confirmed at Rhoda Scholem in 1947. Rabbi Freehoff actually was in charge. Rabbi
Jacob Rothschild?
That's it. Rabbi Jacob Rothschild was actually the executive director, and he ran the Sunday school as well as the Rhoda Scholem Temple. They were very good friends of my parents. As a matter of fact, it was only several years ago that Rabbi Freehoff died, and he was well in his 90s.
How bad a boy were you? What did you do? How'd you live?
Well, I think I was an average child. I think I probably I could have worked harder in school, as most of us could have, and attained higher grades. My grades were always well above average, never what the folks think they should be. It would be nice if everyone only gets straight A's, but that was not something that occurred. However, when I went to college, my grades there were more than adequate, and of course that was cut short by the Korean conflict. When I then went to Korea and served 17 months in Korea as military police officer and then a military police investigator. So I've had a background in police work going back many, many years.
What year did you go to Korea?
1952. I left in 1954.
Mm-hmm. Did your father lick you?
No, Dad was never the disciplinarian at home. I think my mother was a disciplinarian. She was a no-nonsense kind of mother. Very loving mother, very loving father, but Dad attended to the ill, and mother attended to those that were ill-mannered. So yes, I was occasionally one of those, and I had my share of spankings when I was young. And, I didn't become a murderer or a rapist, so I guess maybe spanking kids is all that happened.
I do. The environment you lived in, the early home environment, public and high school. I'd like you to comment on the anti-Semitism of the times, if you encountered it and how.
Well, during not only my career in the police force, but going all the way back to when I started in grade school, for some reason or other, it was very interesting because in Whiteman School, as well as Taylor Aldridge, as well as Pitt, as well as while I was working, I associated with both Jewish youngsters and Gentiles because we seemed to be mixed. I was never posed or faced with anti-Semitism. As a matter of fact, even during the holidays when we were out of high school, there were parties thrown by Jewish families for Hanukkah and what have you. There were quite a few Gentiles that attended them. And we also, conversely, we wound up at parties on Woodland Road given by wealthier Gentiles, and we were always welcome, and there was never a question of anti-Semitism. And, somebody asked me recently, you know, you were a police officer, and then all the way from walking a beat to the chief of police for 35 years, did you encounter anti-Semitism on the police force? And I've got to honestly say, and a lie detector obviously could back me up, I never, never had anybody refer or infer that I was, you know, Jewish, or they didn't like me because I was Jewish. And for some reason or other, I really feel that there's some of our groups today, our minority groups, put a lot of emphasis on either being Jewish or being black or being Hispanic or Italian. And when in fact, if you just go out and you work and you do what you're supposed to do, whether it's getting an education or working a job, leaving the religious part of your life to your heart and as you feel inside, and not discussing it with anybody, I think it never seems to come up. It never came up in my case. And for some reason or other, I was never looking for anti-Semitism. I assume that many people, if they look for something, they're going to find it. Because what happens is they suddenly develop some aura about them that seems to say, go ahead, I dare you to call me a black person, or I dare you to call me a Hebrew or a Jew, or I dare you to call me a Dago, or what have you, you know, and it's a shame. I really think that they seek these things out because they're very sensitive, and I think they'll find them if they do it.
I'd like to ask you about your family's association to either any synagogues, or you already mentioned one. Any clubs, perhaps Concordia or Westmoreland.
Right. Well, my folks, my family historically has belonged to the Concordia Club, which is a city club.
In Oakland?
Right. Well, it originally came from the north side, and then it came to Oakland. And my family was a member of Rhoda Sholem when it was on down on 8th Street. And the building, the original Rhoda Sholem, is still downtown. It still stands, possibly as a warehouse. I'm not sure. I know the building's there. But, of course, it's now located at 5th and Moorwood. And historically, we belonged to the synagogue, we belonged to the Concordia Club, and also Westmoreland Country Club from the time Westmoreland Country Club was in Rosedale, which is in Penn Hills, until it was burnt down it burnt down in a timely fashion. It just heralded in the new year from 1949 to 50. It burnt down during they were having the New Year's festivities there.
You had some early jobs.
Well, I had many jobs. I always wanted to work because for some reason or other, I enjoyed working. During the war, I ran a freight elevator in Schoenick Warehouse at 1221 Penn Avenue, and that was my job. Of course, I was only 14 or 15, I forget what it was. I could run the freight elevator. However, I think the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania said no one can run an elevator in the Commonwealth until you're 16. But during the war, these silly laws were waived because everybody had to do their part. Later on, I worked at the gas station. I think every kid's worked in a gas station at one time or other. If nothing more, just to learn a little bit about the car that he's driving, whether it's used or new, so he can keep it on the road. I worked for a very good friend of mine, and we're still friends today, George Francis Merge Motor Company, with Wilkins and Whiteman, and of course, for a short period of time, they were 5th and St. James. And I do know cars. I have ordered cars. As a matter of fact, one of my prime jobs with the police force was to order police packages with our cars so that we had the correct suspension and engine and so on and so forth. And I worked for him until I went to Korea. When I came back from Korea for a year or so, I worked for him until the civil service list was posted. And I was then taken into the police force. So basically, I
remember what year that civil service, the year of the civil service test?
Yeah, I took the civil service test in 1957, in the spring of 1957, and I was hired. That was when it was given. As a matter of fact, it was given several months prior to me leaving the service, and I had to wait 3 years until they gave the test again, or otherwise I'd have 38 years on the police force. It was in 1957, the spring of 57, and I was hired in the fall of 57, 1957.
One question. How old were you when you ran the freight elevator?
I'd leave school and I'd go down there.
Teenager.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And then I'd run the freight elevator till about 8 o'clock at night, and then I'd take the streetcar back home, much to the chagrin of my parents. But Dad said it isn't bad, you know, that he's a little bit industrious and wants to do something. And I guess that's about the thing that he can do the least and not get hurt. And beyond that, the war was going on, so all kids were doing little jobs here and there. But that was when I was 14 or 15. I know I wasn't driving or anything.
Tell us about your earliest police work then.
Well, I started to spend time with the police force in 1947. I was 16 at the time, and I had just gotten my driver's license, and I had always wanted to be a policeman. Carrying a gun, that wasn't important to me, but I liked the idea of investigating crime. I liked the idea of arresting bad guys and also helping those in need. Policemen do that, but there's very little in print or on television, so the public seems to overlook the fact that police help as many people as they arrest during that war.
Are you saying that you were 16 when you were in the police?
I didn't say that. I said when I was spending time with the police force. Oh. I was loafing with them, to use a vernacular. I loafed with the police force. And it's ironic, I started to loaf with the police in 47, and I became a policeman in 57. But I got to know the police officers. I spent time during some homicide investigations here in town that were sensational.
What station was that? That
was number 11 station, which you couldn't find if you had a map. Number 11 station is Northumberland Street Station, which is now number 6. Okay. So they renumbered it.
Near my house.
Yeah, that's right. And as a matter of fact, I was I was in the last class that attended, that was our police academy on the second floor of then number 11 station, number 6 station today. And even today, years later, the classroom is still there with the chairs in it. However, of course, we have a brand new academy which started in 1958 on Washington Boulevard right near the Run Road. Police and fire, and of course, paramedics.
You know, I forgot something I want to go back to. Summarize your that Korean enlistment you had. You said that you were police there. We'll talk about it a little bit more.
All right, I was actually in the 336 rather, MP battalion here in town, which was headed by James Slusser. And of course, he later became superintendent of police. Today the word is chief, then it was superintendent, essentially the same position. And I joined that because during our summer camp programs, we went to Fort Meade, Maryland, and we performed police duties in Washington, D.C., and Baltimore. We walked beats with the local police because during the Korean conflict, and shortly before that, there were quite a few soldiers, sailors, Marines in these two cities, and of course, the civilian policemen always wanted an MP or a military policeman to be with them at the time of an arrest, because we would then take jurisdiction and take them back to camp. But in any event, I spent time there, and then when I went into the service, I decided I was going to be drafted. There was no question about it. Just a matter of time, so I enlisted, and I beat the draft by 3 days. So my enlistment stood in the draft. That was the end of that. And one of the reasons I wanted to enlist, I was a PFC, and I was due to be a corporal due to the time I had spent in the service. I went through the basic training. When I got to Korea, I told the company commander that I was a corporal, and he said, "No, you're being paid as a private, and I'm just a PFC." And a short time thereafter, orders came through, and it was a considerable sum of money because all the time I had served, I wasn't getting my wage. And by the time he had finally acknowledged the fact that I was, in fact, a corporal, I then went in and I was interviewed for sergeant, which I made shortly thereafter. So I had quite a bit of rank in the military police, which is unusual because there isn't much rank in the military police. And it's usually regular army, and they don't like it. And I think you know, enlisted reservists and draftees. That was just not something they liked. But in any event, I spent quite a bit of time over there in Korea. I was in Busan, and I wound up in Seoul only a few times. I arrived shortly after they broke out of the Busan perimeter and saw plenty of action, not as a combat soldier, because I wasn't that. I saw plenty of action in planes and what have you, and helicopters. I was familiar with several of the MASH units we had there in the Busan perimeter. And by God, it was just exactly as Alan Alda portrayed MASH, 4077 or whatever it is. It's very, very similar. If you didn't laugh over there in Korea, as sad a war as that was, I think you would really cry.
Did you go up north beyond the parallel? Were you ever up in that north part?
No, I didn't go up that. I didn't go up to Panmunjom, which was where they were negotiating the truce. And they'd been negotiating the truce for some time. However, the communists were fairly strong at that time, or at least they thought they were. And of course, recently we found out that a lot of it's been a paper tiger because it collapsed almost instantly, which it could have done long before. But unfortunately, the right people weren't in to make it happen. But I did, I wasn't near the Chosun Reservoir or any of the other places, but I did see Seoul. And the cities that I saw, Busan and Seoul, they had been bombed, and they looked nothing like the magnificent cities that now exist or currently exist.
When were you discharged?
I was discharged the end of August of 1954.
Mm-hmm. Then you had 5 years from 54 to 57.
53.
Just three.
Just about three.
Yeah.
Why do I have 1954?
That's when I went in.
Yeah.
And I came out in 54.
Then he got into police force in 57.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about university.
University of Pittsburgh, I was always interested in political science. And I took liberal arts course, and I took some of the courses I liked. I had thought of becoming an attorney. Then when I was a policeman and had to deal with some of the attorneys, I thought it was better just to be a policeman without being an attorney. It didn't impress me. And in any event, plus the fact that even in those days, which I'm going back 40 years ago, just about, and or at least 40 years ago, it was long enough ago that law was becoming competitive then, and you had to be darn good as an attorney in order to make a living. And most attorneys, I was surprised to find out, were making hardly more than even police officers in those days. And the same is true today. They're making so many attorneys, in other words, so many people are going to law school and want jobs, that there are very few neophyte attorneys that are making more than $16,000 to $18,000 a year. That's barely enough to keep yourself in course.
Why then are there so many attorneys?
I assume that quite a few people like the idea of having a license and being called a professional. But the irony of it is, today, under the Police Municipal Training Act in Pennsylvania, every police officer, including myself, must also have a license. So therefore, I guess you can call us professionals. But I think a lot of people like the idea of being doctors, attorneys. If you're very successful, I think one of the reasons that many, many people become attorneys today is not from the criminal end, but from the civil end. Because if you happen to have one case, and you have some clients, and you sue General Motors, and you get a tremendous award, just the award that you will receive as an individual from that particular suit as the attorney, if you lived at 5% for the rest of your life on several million dollars, you would never have to work another day in your life. It's the greatest annuity policy that you can have. And I think almost every attorney is looking for that big civil case where they're going to make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's nice. I like that. We didn't talk enough about Pitt. You say that
The university.
Political science.
I took political science. I took accounting. Been the best accountant. As a matter of fact, my family, my wife, Debbie, she definitely keeps the records. There's no question about it. And so therefore I'm relieved of that duty. Two and two are still four. I rarely make it five anymore. But in any event, why, the University of Pittsburgh, I thought I received a very decent education. I remember that a semester was $400 when I went. Lord knows what it is now. It was $800 for the whole year. It's considerably higher. And of course, I realized professors then were grossly underpaid. There's no question about it. Today, I think they're grossly overpaid. But then, are so are the basketball players, the football players, and the
They're not in the same
baseball.
League. They're still not in the same league.
No, they're not.
Did you graduate?
No, I did not graduate.
Well, then why'd you leave?
I said because the Korean College went back.
But you didn't go back?
No, I didn't go back. I went back to, yes, I did. I took several classes when I came back of night school. Right after I had started them, then I was accepted as a police officer, and I found out I was working two shifts for I worked out of Superintendent Jim Slusser's office, as did my partner who I chose, and we found out we had very little time for anything else, and I was unable to complete it. And I was hoping someday to cash in on that overtime, but I found out it's not available.
Well, I think it's time to ask about your wife. When did you meet her? When did you get married?
Well, I met my wife in the late 60s. Some of the policemen seemed to feel that it was in the Mardi Gras on Walnut Street. And a fellow by the name of Edelstein owned that. He was a classmate of mine. He did, in fact, own it. But nevertheless, my wife and I were friends for a long time. We had mutual respect, great love for each other. We were married on Memorial Day. What month is that?
September.
No, it's much about Memorial Day. We were married on what day were we married? That's a tough one. Memorial Day. We were married on Saturday. The 29th of what month? May. That's it. May.
29th.
Okay. Well, I'm having a blank. Anyhow, we were married on the 29th of May of
1971.
But anyhow, well, it's unique because the 12th of May is my wife's birthday. And then you have Mother's Day, which is usually around that time. That's the second. Exciting thing in May, and the third is our wedding anniversary,
yes,
which is on the 29th.
And her whole name
is Deborah Ann Spoor.
S-P-O-O-R.
Spoor. Right.
And she has been your one and only?
Yes, absolutely. For now, 21, going on 22 years. Matter of fact, it's so long I can't remember not being there.
Mm-hmm. At least. Do you remember how much you were making?
When I first joined the police force in 1957, I was making a great sum of $3,850 a year, which was roughly around $75 a week. Mm-hmm. Of course, my father was somewhat upset, and he said, "See, I told you so. You can't live in Squirrel Hill and raise a family. Be married, raise a family on $75 a week." Well, it was obvious that was true. But however, like all parents, they feel that when they see somebody enter a profession or they see somebody enter a job, they think that they're going to remain at that level forever. And I knew better. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, in 1957, I was a police officer. By 1963 or 64, I forget right now, I became a lieutenant. 1965, I was promoted to inspector. In 1966 or 67, I was promoted to chief inspector. And in 1977, I was promoted to assistant superintendent, which is comparable to today's assistant chief. And in 1990, I was promoted to position of chief of police.
That's a very nice summary of your career there. Could you give us an idea of the pay rates approximately on some of them, not necessarily?
Well, I'll tell you this, through the years, I can't remember. I do remember as an inspector, as a chief inspector of police, mm-hmm. the inspectors made $12,000 a year in the late 60s and early 70s, and I made $13,000 a year. Mm-hmm. That was quite a bit of money, but really not a whole heck of a lot to get married on. However, I went from $3,850 a week when I joined the job to the current salary when I retired a year ago of $64,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And their benefits?
We have many fringe benefits. Most civil servants have good fringe benefits. We have your medical plan. In other words, we have Blue Cross, Blue Shield. We had a dental plan, which we still have. I still have, even in retirement, Blue Cross and Blue Shield. We have 14 paid holidays a year. We have, of course, 2 days off a week. I'm referring to everybody on the police force. Mm-hmm. So actually, we have 104 days a year off, plus 14, which would be sick days. 14 holidays. I think it's a very rewarding career, but I didn't take it for the fringe benefits because when I came on Blue Cross, I was paying $7 a month toward my Blue Cross. I think the city was